Stephen De Silva is a guide at the Abbey in St Albans.
Indeed. And I've been a guide for almost 40 years at the cathedral, so it's been really interesting to see the developments.
And presumably this is a voluntary activity, is it?
Yes, there are about 80 voluntary guides at the cathedral. We do 3 guided tours a day to anyone who turns up, but we're also just available during the day on peripatetic guiding, moving around, talking to our visitors, offering interpretation and insight into the place. Some people have a clear view of English history and some don't. And so it's nice to be able to fit that in and help them understand what they're seeing in a broader context.
And having spent some of your working career as a teacher, you're quite used to explaining things.
Yes.
And answering questions.
Indeed. And also sometimes perhaps too clear a voice. I have been accused as a guide sometimes of being heard from one end of the building to the other. That's just the teacher projection in me.
It's a fairly echoey building.
It is indeed.
Let's go to the origins of this building then, this Abbey Cathedral, St Alban. Alban himself was a citizen? What do you know about him?
If we reconstruct the facts as we have them now, we think he was a Romano-British citizen. Certain families in the conquered nations cooperated with the Romans, some didn't. Families that cooperated were given the rank of citizen. Alban's death by execution indicates he was probably from that rank, a citizen of the city of Verulamium, the municipium of Verulamium.
And at that point, the city was still where we think of it today? The wall was still there? Or am I completely out?
No, the wall was in place, but we're looking at the city down in the valley, of course, covering the area of St. Michael's as it is today. Think of the Roman theatre, think of St. Michael's Church, which is actually on top of the Basilica or the Forum. That's the centre of the Roman city. It's not up on the hill where you think of St. Albans today.
And the hill was chosen, we'll come into this a bit later, but because that was in fact the execution site, is that right?
There's certainly Roman burials on the hillside. There are Roman burials outside the city walls. The Roman burials, as far as I understand it, on the hill where the cathedral is now, are not noble people by any means. I make a bit of a joke about this, but if you want the very wealthy, you have to go up to Waitrose to find the very wealthy burials. 'Twas ever thus. On the hillside at the cathedral, we're looking at poor burials. It's where you would expect a criminal to have been buried after his execution. It's the right context.
Okay, let's go back to Alban then. He was potentially a Romano-Briton, so he was a good family. He obviously got persuaded to change his theological position. What's the story?
It's a wonderful story, and I think that's the ultimate question. What made this ordinary man do this extraordinary thing? That's one of the ways we talk about him. He gave shelter to a wandering Christian priest. Whether that priest knocked on the door and simply said, "Help me," or whether there was some other interaction between them, who knows? Perhaps a commercial one. Perhaps Alban was running a business and there was some interaction. The priest needed hiding. There was clearly an investigation into subversives in the town. Christianity was still a subversive religion. Subversive because it demanded loyalty to one God, not to the Roman pantheon, and certainly not to the emperor. Emperors were divine and to be worshipped. This, of course, was anathema to a Christian priest. And so Alban takes that priest into his home and gives him shelter. If you look at the story as told by Matthew Paris, who's later, but also by the Venerable Bede, who's perhaps one of the earliest writers, Alban is impressed by the priest's faith. He's impressed by this sort of dedication, perhaps a quiet resolve, who knows? And Alban asks to become a Christian as well. And so the priest receives him as a Christian into the church.
And of course, because it's so long ago, we're here talking about the 3rd century, isn't it?
Yes, we're looking at towards the end of the 200s, perhaps 300.
Okay, we don't have enough records to know whether there was a great deal of subterranean Christianity coming in from the fringes or...
It was certainly, that would have been the pattern through a lot of the empire, because of course we're talking, 200 years after perhaps the youngest of the apostles, eventually as old men, had perhaps died themselves. We know about the Christian martyrs in Rome. There were Christian martyrs throughout the empire. Alban is the first Christian martyr we can identify having crossed the channel.
Okay, so he makes the mistake of refusing to see the emperor as a god, or as to... Is that
yes,
the way?
I mean, what happens is the priest needs to escape, and so Alban and the priest exchange outer clothing, cloaks. The priest probably would have been identifiable as a stranger. Alban would have perhaps worn a cloak, either showing his rank as citizen, but certainly a well-to-do person around Verulamium. Alban gives him that cloak. The priest gets away. Alban is then taken before the tribunal and questioned, why have you done this? Why has this happened? He's given a chance to renounce his new faith. He refuses to do that. Bede records the words, "I am called Alban. I worship and adore the true and living God who made all things." In a sense, that condemns him to death because of his refusal to worship and to offer incense to the emperor. There probably would have been a bust of the emperor, a portrait of the emperor. Alban would have, should have, as a loyal citizen, taken a handful of incense, thrown that upon the fire to show an offering to the emperor, but he refuses to do so. He condemns himself by his words.
And that would have been the trial, as it were. They wouldn't then go to another trial. I mean, he'd committed...
That, in effect, seems to be... The earliest record that we have shows that trial happening in front of the governor of the city, and he condemns himself. The governor then sentences him to death by beheading, as we later know.
Right. And would that execution have taken place fairly quickly? Would that have been...
Probably. It's hard to say. I'm not going to put days on it, sure. But certainly there's no evidence that he languished in jail for a long time. Right. He was taken outside of the city, a great crowd follow. Public executions were always spectacles, I suspect. They follow him outside of the city walls up onto the hillside where the execution takes place.
And at this point, we get all sorts of other stories, like the executioner's eyes popping
out.
Yes,
there are. As the story gets embroidered as time goes on, certain symbolic things happen to it. So if you think about the executioner's eyes falling out, it's a lovely gory detail. And the children, when we tell the story, love the gory detail. But of course, what it's really about is spiritual blindness. You see, the executioner is blind to who this wonderful man really is. Same with when the water, the river Ver, parts to let Alban through.
Is that to let him through to his execution?
Yes, to let him through. So the waters part to let Alban ascend the hillside because he has to cross the Ver. And of course, again, this is a biblical kind of reference to a holy man, the way the waters would have parted for Moses in the past. There may also be a sort of symbolic of his baptism in a way. You know, water and baptism have that connection. These stories are embroidered with layers and layers of meaning.
Another story that is often told is that Alban's head rolled down the hill and landed at Holywell or Holywell. Is that...
There is very little evidence for that part of the story. That is a very typical story about beheaded saints in the Celtic world. If you look at the Venerable Bede and if you look at Matthew Paris, no, I'm afraid we can't get the rolling head.
So that was just a local one by the local tourist.
I think that was just a good story that people liked. Frequently, saints went off then and picked up their heads and brought them back. But this, that embellishment doesn't exist with the St. Alban.
Okay. So then on that spot, which was not there was no church or religious building
at all. No, on that hillside, as far as we know. I mean, there were clearly Roman temples and further down in Verulamia. But no, there's no evidence for anything earlier than Roman burials on the hillside.
Okay, so what timescale now? We're talking about 300s, you said.
Yeah.
Now we've got to get to a point where we've got a cathedral on the side.
Yeah.
What's the scale?
Early on, it's speculation. Let's just say 300 as a kind of, a round marker for Alban. Within a decade or so, the Emperor Constantine passes the Edict of Milan, which allows Christians to worship freely. I'd like to think that the people who knew Alban built that first church over his grave. The pattern throughout the Roman Empire is that Christians worshipped at the graves of the martyrs. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. That's a very ancient saying in Christianity. His grave would have been remembered. They probably worshipped there in secret at first, and then when permission to build was allowed, which would have been within 10 or 20 years, probably a very simple structure would have been erected over that grave. We have absolute evidence that in 429 there is a grave there because there's an eyewitness account by a visiting bishop, Germanus, who says there's a church there in 429. So, and he doesn't indicate it's a new church either. So the first church is there.
Would that have been a very primitive building, or do you think any?
Probably. We can look at martyriums, they're called, places where a martyr is honoured. We can look at them elsewhere in the Roman Empire, and they would have been centred on the grave, so a shrine would have been central to the building. They would have had an altar for the mass and whatever else, but probably a simple building, nothing like the scale of what we might see today. That building was probably enlarged several times, but the next time we have a date for it is 793, when Offa, king of Mercia, comes to this place, and in penance for a crime he has committed, he takes monks and nuns who are living in a building on the hillside, and he organizes them into the Order of St. Benedict, a Benedictine community, and he builds them a new abbey. So whatever was there in 793 was pulled down and rebuilt. The female community of the nuns was moved. It carried on being a male monastic community. And that 793 building is the one that's replaced by the one you see today.
When was that?
Begun in 1077, finished in 1115, 900 years ago this year.
Do we know the motive for pulling down the old one and putting up a new one? It just wasn't big enough, it wasn't grand enough?
Probably practical, in that the Normans clearly, we're talking about a Norman building now. The Normans wanted something large. They wanted a large community. The first abbot who's appointed is the nephew of the Archbishop of Canterbury. So Paul of Caen's the nephew of Lanfranc. So there was probably every intention to build a great community. But there's a secular reason too. The Normans want to show they're in charge. And so, of course, there's a huge building program throughout England. Mm-hmm. Think of the White Tower at the Tower of London. All these towers are being great buildings. They're being erected to show the Normans are here to stay. So it's a double statement. It's a religious statement, but it's also a secular statement.
And of course, it had the advantage of many other cathedrals. On top of a hill, you could see it from a fantastic position,
absolutely.
So there we've got to the Normans, and we're now, let me think, how many hundred years ago is that?
So we're 900 years ago, the building is finished.
So that's...
The second Norman abbot finishes off the building in 1115.
Good. Well, there's a great deal more we could talk about the Abbey, and I'm sure we probably will do. Stephen, thank you very much. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about one particular aspect, which is the Magna Carta and its relationship with St. Albans. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.